excellent day for an exorcism.
Do you know what the most frightening thing in the world is? It's fear.
Every you do, don't fall.
Hello, welcome to episode number 38. This is a special edition of A Year in Horror. For the remainder of this month, we are going to be chatting with my good buddy, Mark Canali. We're going to be talking to him about some really interesting folk horror gems. This whole thing, you can see this as a bonus feature to the main 1973 big hitter that came out last week. So I've put together a few extras here for you. And Mark and myself, we are going to go all in depth on this subject. So next week, we're going to begin a two-parter where we go, as I say, in depth on the creation and the end result of the soundtrack to The Wicker Man. And that, of course, is the 1973 version. A bloody course it is. I can't think of any that I prefer, so I'm going to go out on a limb here and just say that that is my favourite soundtrack for any film of all time. And I can't wait for you to hear those chats. They were so much fun. So much fun. Thank you, Mark, for that. But before we get there, for right now, my good self and my horror husband, yep, Mark again, we recently took part on the online premiere of Woodlands Dark and Days Bewitched, A History of Folk Horror, and that is part of the Fright Fest Festival. So it's a new 3-hour documentary that does exactly what it says it will. It gives us a massive history on folk horror. Kyla Janice has put together this masterwork, and we thought we would review it. It's easy. It'll only take a few minutes. No, it didn't take a few minutes. Prepare yourself. We got chatting for 90 minutes all about this wonderful film. I will see you on the other side. Hey, hello. How you doing, Mark?
Hello.
So, we just watched a documentary, exact title being Woodlands Dark and Days Bewitched.
Yep. A History of Folk Horror.
So, right, okay. So, that is part of the same title, A History of Folk Horror.
It is. There's a colon there. Yep.
Okay. Right, okay. So, even that is ridiculous.
It's a long title as well, isn't it?
It's giving you a little warning.
Yeah, 3 hour and 13 minutes of, oh god, how do we describe it as an overall intense? Well, the first words that come to mind when you think about it, yeah, pretty enveloping, intense,
thorough,
dense, extraordinary, broad. Yeah, I mean, didn't it feel a bit like going to some sort of like a conference or a series of lectures on a really big subject in about 3 hours? You know, it's like you just spent like a week's worth of stuff all sort of crammed in, and I mean beautifully crammed in, but all this information. And it reminded me a bit of kind of going to see, I don't know, going to see like the Lord of the Rings films in the cinema. So going to see like the Return of the King, you know, and kind of, you know, what was that about 3 hours or something? The original cut of that, I think the cinematic cut was about 3 hours ish or something.
Pretty close.
You know, when you kind of walked out at the end of it, kind of blinking and sort of, you know, you weren't quite sure where you were for a second there, and it was just like you'd gone on a little journey, and you know, to some other planets while you're in this sort of dark room, and then you come out and suddenly you're back on planet Earth, and you kind of wander around staring at people's faces. and pointing at them going, ah, what's that?
Of course, watching it at home, we didn't even get to do that.
Yeah, I mean, as we were saying, I was sitting at the end of my garden because I couldn't watch it in the front room because, you know, I've got a little kid running around. So I had to sort of tuck myself down the bottom of the garden in a shed, which, you know, it's a pretty good place to watch something, yeah, folk horror documentary in. It's put together incredibly well, really, really beautifully put together.
Before we get there, like the actual process of buying a ticket, having the website all set up, you can't have a break because this is a premiere, so you can't pause it. You can't, you know, watch it 5 minutes late and start it 5 minutes late. You just have to be there and then present and focused.
Did you try pausing it at any point? Because I did. I forgot. And it was naturally, I went to hit the space bar kind of thing. It was like...
No, I did not.
Work.
I was rooted to the spot. Yeah, I enjoyed that whole process. Like, yeah. I feel for a going forward with the podcast, like any films that I get sent like that, I'm quite happy to do that because I can't do these London premieres that I keep getting invited to, or the press screening, should I say. I just can't make them because of where I live and my job. So it's real tricky doing it like this. I loved every minute of the whole process.
It did feel really nice, didn't it? It felt kind of, you know, when the first bit popped up and it was the sort of the lobby of the cinema with the Fright Fest stuff going in it. I mean, I tell you what, hasn't Fright Fest come a long way? Yes, it used to be in the Prince Charles Cinema, you know, just sort of, you know, with a person hoovering in the background. And now it's like, I don't know what cinema that is, Leicester Square one. I can't remember, is it the Curzon one in Leicester Square? But it's like, it's beautiful now and all the kind of backdrops and everything. And it's like, wow, okay. Uh-huh. That's come a long way in 20, 25 years or whatever it is. It's amazing. Yeah, it was an exciting, it was a nice sort of build up, and you did feel that idea of, you know, you were sitting there watching it with a load of other people at that moment. It's a bit like a TV show, like an old school TV thing. Well, you knew that it was going to be a kind of what was on at that time, and everyone had to sit down, and everyone around the country would be sitting down watching it at that minute. And you were kind of having almost this sort of this experience alone, but also communally. But there was no one there, kind of thing. A weird sort of spiritual thing going on.
I mean, I loved it. After it finished, I watched a documentary on how it was put together because I didn't think that was enough. I hadn't seen enough.
You watched the documentary on the documentary?
Yeah,
wow. I did.
And it's really weird how it happened. So in that little intro, Kayla Janice, she comes on, she introduces it, and then you're into the film. So afterwards, there was this, because it premiered at South by Southwest before, so there was a little bit of press around that. And she sat down with an interviewer and discussed like the process of making it. And she did mention in our little preamble that it was originally for just a featurette on Blood on Satan's Claw. What was fascinating was the way that she handed in a 2-hour final product, and they just said, well, it's, you know, it's longer than the film, but okay, is there another folk horror documentary out there? The answer was, when they looked around, not really. Why don't you just go and finish it off? So that's how it's all come together. So that's why this film is sort of cut up into them ways. And you can tell she's asking different sort of questions to different people because it's different timelines when she's actually doing it for different projects.
Yeah, that's right. And the sense of, as you said, being split almost into chapters. And she did mention as well, as she's a writer, and this is her first film, she's not a filmmaker, she's a writer, she really approached it almost like writing a book. So you felt there was a sense of there being the different chapters and not the research going into each one individually, but the fact that one seemed to lead on to another was quite nice as well. But yeah, Severin Films, who produced it, and obviously we're producing the edition of The Blood on Satan's Claw. Originally, yeah, I've listened to a bit of the podcast. They actually have a podcast, and they did about a 3-hour podcast with her, actually, about them. I didn't listen to the whole thing of that, but I listened to sort of the first bit of it. So yeah, the same sort of explanation, but it's interesting because it's involving the guys at Severin Films as well, and listening to their kind of reactions to it originally. And they were just so excited about it because their big thing was the idea of it's almost this sort of archival sort of thing going on, where they were sort of, they were just, they love the idea of finding out new films. And what Kayla was bringing in to them was this, well, I've never heard of that. I've never heard of this. Does this even exist? Is it on DVD? Is it on Blu-ray? And that naturally, that's their business. And they were getting like really like hyped up with this and sort of saying, so this is, we want to do this. This is great. You know, this is, so you can kind of sense that in the documentary as well, because the way she writes her books as well, they're incredibly thorough. And I mean, just the most amazing writing, film writing, because she doesn't just do her research, she really kind of lives the films. I mean, that's really, she does a lot of stuff where it connects with her life. And you know, there's a real intensity to the research that she does. I mean, you know, the accuracy, but also the volume of the kind of amount of research she did. And you can sense that in it as well. And that's in a way that kind of overload of sort of information you feel is like, it's almost as if it's coming from her kind of brain, coming out the screen and just feeding into your eyes kind of thing. It's like, wow, that's intense. That's kind of like stream of consciousness type stuff. Yeah.
Well, it's like you said at the beginning, it could have fallen down the trap of being a series of lectures. And don't get me wrong, I love being present at a lecture if I'm really thoroughly fascinated by what is being lectured at me. I love that. In fact, I tend to watch lectures on YouTube anyway about horror, just because I'm fascinated by people that know more than me, which is everyone. So yeah, it's great. But the way this...
not now dude, you are now, you're going to be doing a documentary like that in a few years time. Like
no,
Paul Waller's 4-hour documentary on the depraved world of like horror.
Let's start at 1920.
Let me take you to Japan in the 1920s. Yeah.
But do you know what I really loved? I loved after the onslaught of each chapter, you had that like valve of all the animation and the title card sort of thing. Yeah. I loved that. That was such
I wondered if that was going to be a little bit indulgent, maybe. I don't know. I wondered whether they were going to try a bit too hard to make it, you know, if it was going to be sort of reenactments and things like that, or how they were going to use the animation and stuff. But you're right. It was really nicely done, because it was just used relatively sparingly, but really effectively. And all the animations are different styles. Because I think he actually did a bit of animation for her, and she like said, oh right, brilliant, can you do a couple of more? And it was like, all right. And he sort of then sort of did another, they did another bit, and then I think there was a sort of sense of like they then sort of moved through the documentary sort of taking another little bit and then doing it slightly differently and then a different style. And you know, and she was like saying, oh, can you do a pop-up one? Oh yeah, okay, we'll do a pop-up one. So they're all kind of different, which I thought really worked nicely as well through the whole thing. It never felt like it was showing off, or it never felt separate from the rest of the film as well, which was nice.
It was really handy, because it meant that, right, okay, I can adjust my butt. I can shake the pen, make sure the ink is still in there. So it's, God, you know, 3 hours, just smoothing around the sofa.
How many notes did you take? How many pages of notes did you take?
4.
That's not bad. The funny thing is, I started with my little notebook, and I literally got to the second sort of section, the sort of the mainly American sort of section, and it's basically stopped just after that point, because I just got to the point where I was like, I forgot to kind of take notes. I was just sort of just starting to just sort of soak right into the whole sort of screen. I just forgot the really necessary bit for doing scene.
It's not like when I took a notebook to see The Conjuring 3. It's different.
I'd have been more interested reading the notebook.
Okay. Well, if you don't mind, can we take it chapter by chapter?
Yeah, I would. That's a good idea. Yep. Cool.
Okay, so we're going to start off as they did with the Unholy Trinity.
Yeah. So yeah, I suppose as Kayla said, this was her sort of starting point. This was kind of, she thought this was everyone's starting point, which I guess it is, because you know, we start with the sort of things that we've been speaking about in previous podcasts, where, you know, we talked about the sort of Mark Gatiss documentary, and that was mentioned pretty much straight up as one of the first sort of modern mentions of the term. I love the chap on there who actually sort of came up with that. And I love that every time it came back to him, it was just him going, and then I read the term folk horror in something else, and I went, "Whoa, there's my term folk horror." So it seemed to be the only reason he was there in a way. I was like, I made up the term, and then they would come back to me and he'd go, and I made the term up.
Well, if you had, you would.
Yeah, exactly. You'd be telling everyone by now, wouldn't you?
Oh, the magpie brings us tidings of news both fair and foul. She's more cunning than the raven, more wise than any owl. For she brings us news of the harvest, of the barley, wheat and corn, and she knows when we'll go to our graves and how we shall be born. One's for sorrow, two's for joy, three's for a girl and four's for a boy. Five's for silver, six for gold. Seven's for a secret never told. Devil, devil, I defy thee. Devil, devil, I defy thee. Devil, devil, I defy thee.
Yeah, I like the sort of the history of the term and stuff like that. But I think, yeah, it just was that sort of opening where you're sort of sitting there, and I loved it, and I loved the unthanks magpie comes out. Of course, you're like, yeah, there you go. Mm-hmm. The national anthem of folk horror, isn't it? You know, yep. And it's working its way through this stuff, and you're like, you're ticking your boxes. You know, it's a bit like letterboxed on a list. You're going, yep, see, yeah, this is great, and they're talking to the people, and you're seeing, oh, Wicker Man, great. I think there was a quite an intense sort of bit for a Witchfinder General. I always feel a bit guilty for now saying I didn't really like it that much, because everyone goes nuts over it, and I'm like sitting there going, oh. Yeah, right.
I forget how harsh that film is. Whenever I see a clip, I just go, oh my goodness, I remember that.
Yeah, exactly. Although I remember just sort of like saying to you, I just thought it was about a pair of con men. Maybe I'm kind of missing some of the more subtle contexts. Some of people talking about, you know, the politics of the Civil War period. Well, it's just a bunch of guy and horses. Well, there you go, it's a western. I hadn't really thought about that, you know. It's like, oh, okay, that's how I may have to watch this again now. But which is what a good film doc should do, I suppose. It should make you question what you thought about stuff and go back to it. It kind of just went the way you thought it should do, and there was a couple of bits I hadn't seen. Requiem for a Village, oh, never heard of that one, that's good. The Living Grave was one I hadn't heard before, which is by the same guy that wrote Pender's Fen. And I hadn't heard of that, and then subsequently just found it on YouTube, which is quite nice. So that's going to be a little watch. So, you know, so far, so good. You're kind of watching, you're thinking, okay. And I think that first section just felt lovely, comfortable. You know, I think the way that Kayla had actually said at the beginning as well, that she was talking to a lot of the British people that had been writing books on it, and they were all kind of like, oh, folk horror. Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. That's kind of yesterday's news. I think we've moved on from.
Yeah. Come on.
Because we're all sort of sitting around like going, yeah, this is good. Because then it moves on to section two.
Before we get there, I just want to, I've marked a couple of things. So I was just so impressed by the quality of talking heads that we're invited on. Academics and the filmmakers, the people that were there at the time, people, you know, there was interesting theories being dotted about from these three films that already most people think they would already know most stuff about. And they were just throwing bits in them like, oh, okay, I haven't looked at it that way. That's nice. But as a little advert, I've got to do it before we go into section two. Blood on Satan's Claw, episode 28. That's where it is on A Year in Horror. And Wicker Man next week. So after you're listening to this, me and Mark, who you're listening to right now, we go on a massive, massive two-part about the music behind.
3 hours and 13 minutes of it, I think. Near enough. I was going to say, you're saying about the Talking Heads, is actually the listening to the podcast as well, she's mentioning, because there's a massive box set coming out. That's on sale at the moment. Severin Films are doing like a big box set of stuff, which no doubt we'll talk about later, probably with it. There's outtakes. So there is stuff that wasn't used in this, obviously, but there's a lot of actual Talking Heads that weren't even in it. Like, for example, the guy who actually did the soundtrack for the Blood on Satan's Claw was interviewed and stuff like that. So there is even more stuff that wasn't even remotely even put in there. I agree. As I said before, the thoroughness the actual filmmaking and the preparation and stuff, absolutely amazing. And yeah, the Talking Heads, brilliant. Prevenge of Alice Lowe, you mentioned, which you were dead happy about as well, being in there. I just thought she had some really nice content actually as well. That was good.
I love that woman. She's my favorite actor at the moment. I just, every time I see her face, I'm so thrilled that she's going to be entertaining me for the next hour and a half or whatever. I love it. Okay, well, let's go to section two now. This is where all of a sudden, it's like, as you say, you're with your comfort blanket, but here we go. We're just going to jump off this cliff. We're just walking along. Whoop, there it goes. It's gone. So there is a ton of stuff I sort of know, I've heard of. And then there is this ton of stuff for someone that is exploring horror in the little depths of the every nook I can find. And yet, I've not heard of a ton of stuff, and I've already spoken to some of my horror journalist friends and things like that, and there was a ton of stuff they've never heard of themselves. Like, amazing. It didn't seem like this was unimportant fluff. This was like stuff that you really instantly go, oh, I want to see this. Like, how did you feel about like this second section when they're exploring England in a bit more depth?
Yes, I know what you mean. There's a huge amount of sort of depth. I suppose this is mainly the TV stuff that you're sort of saying about. So you've got a lot of the sort of Robin Redbreast, the Ghost Stories for Christmas, M.R. James, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I'll come to you.
Yes. Now, that's stuff that I'd explored a couple of years ago, because when you start with that sort of Unholy Trinity stuff, the first thing you look up on the internet, you get particularly some BFI pages and stuff like that. And the first things they mention is, right, you've got to look at TV stuff. You have to look at it. And so I went on a bit of a sort of crusade, and I tried to find all this stuff either on YouTube or sort of just out there on the internet, you know. Or on sort of Blu-rays and things like that. BFI do sort of a lot of them on Blu-ray. And yeah, that's amazing stuff, because I remember that stuff from when I was a kid. And, you know, obviously I don't remember I can remember watching The Wicker Man and Witchfinder General when I was younger, but not as a kid. But I remember watching a lot of these sort of TV things back in the sort of 80s when I was a kid. And that actually has more of a kind of, I don't know, more of a personal sort of a deeper connection. And that's what brought a lot of it back to me. And we used to, my other half and I would sit and we'd watch this stuff. And, you know, like The Owl Service, and you get sort of, I think it's like, it's probably about 6 half-hour episodes, I think they are. And these things were made for kids. This is British TV that was made for kids. And I'm not joking. This stuff is terrifying. I mean, Children of the Stones and The Owl Service, particularly the sound design, I think is one of the main things that comes across in these things. Absolutely astonishing. And again, you sort of think back, and you kind of get that sort of sense you weren't really aware of where this was coming from. And I think a few people commented on that, about this sort of sense of, it almost felt, yeah, quite natural for the time. This felt very sort of, yeah, this is just the kind of stories that we're surrounded by at the moment as kids. This is our kind of folk stories now. These are our fairy tales in a way, even though they're kind of, well, they feel like very modern kind of fairy tale, rewrites of fairy tales or something. Really interesting.
So I'm only a couple of years younger than you, but I came into the country in 1983, and it was a little village called Hollingbourne. So I recognised straight away, as soon as like things like that, Children of the Stones comes up and it shows you the sort of area around where it was filmed, I recognise this from my youth, you know, I know yeah. all these things. But are you coming home from school and like you've got John Craven's News Round or whatever, and then after that they're going to plunk this on? Is that how it was?
You know, yeah, basically, yes, it was. At least that's how I remember it. I don't remember it being specifically, I can't remember what time of day it was on. I you had things like the Box of Delights and things like that as well, which were also, not so much sort of folk horror type things, but, you know, these were sort of these 80s sort of programs. And they had these very strange feel about them. Again, we've discussed it before, this hauntological sort of thing that they mentioned, this idea of the past and this sort of, I guess they're like this sort of fairy tale idea of telling fairy tales, because in fairy tales, they're inherently quite sinister. But these weren't just the ones that you would be very sort of aware of. They were Hansel and Gretel and stuff like that. These were just these strange stories that you'd no clue. I mean, the owl service comes from an ancient, well, what seems like an ancient Welsh sort of myth, like story, a fairy story type thing, but clearly rewritten. But I would have had no awareness of the story of where it would have come from or anything like that. And yeah, guys like Alan Garner and stuff like that, who wrote that, they were writing a lot of stuff for TV at that point in time. So yeah, a lot of this stuff, the Ghost Stories for Christmas as well, I remember those really well, because those were event television. Those were the sorts of things that everyone sat down and watched, and I can remember those sorts of things. Not all of them, but I can remember them being like 9:30 on a, whatever it would be, a Christmas day or something like that.
Mental.
And those were great at the time, and they still are. I mean, you know, was it A Warning to the Curious? Is what a great, it's a great story. And the M.R. James stories are so good. They're just so creepy and brilliant.
I've seen Whistle and I Come to You, the new one and the old one. I liked them both equally. Really enjoyable. When you go back, or I don't know if you have, but things like The Children of the Stones, have you gone back in recent years? Are they still worth watching today?
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, I have done. I've gone so far as to sort of, I've watched a lot of those Play for Today ones. I managed to get hold of Robin Redbreast and watch that. I've watched a few of the Nigel Neal sort of bits and bobs as well. Some of them I think have stood up a lot better than others. And some of them, I think, if you can really suspend your disbelief, that's not really what you need to do. You have to appreciate sometimes that things that were made for TV in the 1970s and 80s are going to have a certain production value. Mm-hmm. But you have to kind of be aware of it. It's got that kind of Doctor Who feel to it, which is kind of difficult sometimes, because I guess if you were kind of aware of it at the time, it helps. But even still, you really do notice the difference. they date very, very quickly. And I think some of them are better than others. And some of those, the Beasts TV shows, really don't stand up that well. There's a couple of them that are really just, they're almost, you know, you almost feel slightly embarrassed and a little bit of kind of, did we watch this? This is like an episode of, I don't know, just like watching Cracker Jack again or something like that. It's like really sort of, you feel really strange that, you know, this was just kids TV or something like that. But some of them, Ghost Stories for Christmas, I think Robin Redbreast just about is that kind of the borderline. I think that one's definitely worth watching, because it is really a core British folk horror text, if you want to call it that. It's really important. It has that balance of it being a little bit Play for Today, slightly sort of weird, you know, sort of sound sort of quality, where you can hear floorboards creaking as camera people are walking across them or stuff like that. And, you know, it has that real feel of, you know, it is, that's the thing. If you can get through that, it's still really effective and it's still really important. But some of them, maybe not so much.
I recently watched, they did mention a Doctor Who episode, The Demons, and I recently watched it just a few weeks back. Just because people talk about it in the same way they did in this film. Like, you know, you've got the Maypole, you know, you've got these creatures from the earth and things like that. And my God, it was trash. It was so bad. I can't get that time back. And I watched it to the end, because you know how they're split up? It's longer than a normal film, but you know, you can't not watch the final conclusion, the final 25 minutes.
Yeah. Well, you had the Stone Tape as well, which was mentioned in there. And I think that's a really good example, because I love Nigel Neal's stuff. I really do. I think his stuff is just, for the time, his writing was just so important, because very few people were doing this. Yeah. And he was doing it really well. He really was. You know, his Quatermass stuff is genuinely brilliantly written stuff, a lot of it. But my God, the Stone Tape really sort of, I mean, it was a struggle for me sort of technically, because had it dated, I mean, technically it had dated. I mean, apart from the fact they were using computer science and things like that, and wow, computer science stuff from the early 80s. When was that? The Stone Tape was sort of, was it 1980 or maybe the early 80s, something like that. You know, wow, that really dates, you know, when you've got these sort of dot matrix printers coming out and sort of like going in sort of, you know, yeah, the green screens and stuff like that. And people sitting around going, oh, this is, you know, it's really hard. It's really hard to get that, to really sort of get into that world again, particularly as well when it I think one of the hardest things to get into is the cultural aspects as well, because I found that film had some really, was it problematic cultural things to do with like misogyny and stuff like that, that wasn't really intentional, I don't think, wasn't really meant to. I don't think it was meant to be particularly intentional. Maybe I missed it, if it were, maybe I missed some of the subtext, but it just felt really dated in that respect. And it was very laddish. And the woman who was kind of the analyst, but the girlfriend at the same time, and she was so weak and so sort of like, and you know, and she was being targeted by all this sorts, and the emotional sort of heart of it all, and it all felt a bit, you know. So that was, I really liked the story, and I liked what they were saying about it in the documentary, but I struggled with it as a piece of work.
Before we leave, there's a few more things I want to say about this section, but one of them was my first niggle with the documentary. So when I say it's a niggle, well, I'm so glad it was there, because it's a talking point. It's what people would actually consider to be folk horror.
Now, I knew you were going to bring this up, yeah.
the Quatermass in the Pit thing, like for me, okay. I don't see that as folk horror. There's too much technological stuff going on. It's, you know, I know that they're actually pulling something out of the earth, which we've already talked about being, well, that is a key element, you know, that is a key element within.
Yeah, and it is ancient, and it's the idea of the ancient demons, or where we would have got the idea from religion from, this idea that it was an alien race kind of thing. Yeah, I knew you were going to sort of bring this up. We'd already sort of discussed it, I think, when we were watching it a bit. We were sort of mentioning this. Yes, at this point, or maybe just the section after this point, the section where we move out of the British Isles, that's the section which naturally I start to get a bit twitchy and start getting a little bit, I start getting a bit possessive about it. I start getting a little bit.
We'll get there. This section finishes off with Lair of the White Worm. Not seen it. It looks great.
Oh, I saw it a long time ago. So long ago, I can barely remember it, but I do remember it. It's Ken Russell, and it is about as bonkers Ken Russell as you can possibly get. But I also remember it being fairly boring as well.
No,
I think the way they cut the bits that they showed in the doc.
Yeah.
I think they're a lot of the bits that you wouldn't, you know.
Got it.
Yeah, I think 90% of the film isn't like that, if I remember rightly. It's a little bit. Yeah, doesn't it have Hugh Grant in it?
I hope so.
I think it's got a young Hugh Grant, I think. And this might be, I might be completely wrong on this. People could be shouting at their headphones. It's a little bit kind of middle class, sort of 80s yuppies sort of having dinner parties. Oh. And the kind of, I think that's what I sort of vaguely remember. I might be completely wrong. It was a long time ago. I should rewatch it and maybe sort of talk about it then, yeah.
And my first sort of, yes, thank goodness, already in there. My first moment where I'm just like, oh my word, I'm in for a ride here. Looking at the time, seeing how much I've got left. When they showed a field in England, I got my first little chills on my back. I was so thoroughly just thrilled that they put that up there.
I got goosebumps many times through this, I have to say. Even the opening credits with Magpie, which I love anyway, as a bit of music. I love the Unfangs, but yeah, just the whole bit, and just the, oh, I got goosebumps through loads of this doc, definitely. And yeah, you're right, that bit was really nicely done, because it had that intensity. because that film is such an intense film. That's a hard film in a lot of ways, isn't it, just to get through. And they matched it with the music, and they, you know, that was really good, that bit. Yeah.
Part three, paganism and witchcraft.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so we're not quite, well, we are sort of American, and we're edging
towards it, aren't we? Yeah, we're kind of edging towards it, because I feel what starts to happen is when you start moving it to America, to the US, to North America, I should say, they kind of have to bring in occult and witchcraft. And this is where you start getting a little bit kind of, well, okay, hold on a minute. So am I starting to get, you know, this sort of sense of, you know, are we gatekeeping? This is where we start sort of falling into this trap. Are we gatekeeping a little bit? No, that's not folk horror. No, you can't say that's folk horror. What's going on here? This is a cult horror, which, but then you sort of sit there and think, how are you drawing those lines? Aren't those lines fairly arbitrary, you know?
Yeah, but then, you know, at the same time, then if John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever goes into a field, it's not folk horror. Where is the line? You know, there's a line somewhere.
I don't realise that's the film they missed out on, this whole thing. See, she wasn't that thorough, was she?
No, she was not.
She missed that one.
I'm quite happy with the inclusion of things like Quatermass, because even though for me, I wouldn't consider that folk horror if I was going to organise my DVD collection in that manner. I wouldn't put it in there, but I can see that there's enough elements of it in there. It's when it's overwhelmingly something else. That's when I'll be like, whoa, just because of these couple of elements.
Yes. I think there's an important thing we'll maybe come to later on that they mention right at the end of the film, of the doc. And I think it's quite an important thing, because it's going to reflect back on this discussion about what it is, what it means. We've always said before that folk horror kind of seems to mean a different thing to every person that you ask. Oh, see, the witch is a good one, because this is where we start getting the join. The Witch being a film obviously about the pilgrims in America. So it has this weird feel where it's a kind of a film with British people in it, with British actors. It could be, you feel almost it could be set somewhere in rural Britain, even though you can sense also it can't be, because it feels much more remote than that. But clearly it's American. You know, made by an American, it's set in America, it's about the pilgrims, it's about this in this the American Northwest. So you get this sort of connection, and this is where the witch thing starts sort of coming, where you almost feel witchcraft is, and they make that point in the documentary, is the connection with North America and folk horror and this British sort of folk horror. And the witchcraft thing is again, we've mentioned before as well, this idea of modern witchcraft, modern paganism, its relationship to real, I don't even know what that would mean, but the real sort of pagan cultures that would have existed in countries in this country. And you know, there was a nice quote, which I'll paraphrase, from the woman that was the folklore sort of expert, and she said it's quite annoying, because every time these films are made, people go more and more into, oh, this is actually what was really going on. And then you had the two guys talking about the Wicker Man as well, which we will go into obviously in the podcast in more depth, but they were saying the same thing that we did about the idea of whether any of these things were real, whether they were just political propaganda written by, you know, quote unquote more civilized cultures writing about the sort of peasants or the sort of the terrible sort of savages that lived in these dark lands. You know, it starts getting so mixed up, and when you get that kind of sense of when it goes over to the States, and that's where it starts sort of getting this thing where, so we can bring the witchcraft over because the witchcraft feels sort of pagan, it feels old, and this sort of revival of witchcraft in the sort of 60s and 70s, which we know about from music and stuff like that, really, we know that really well. Bring that into the States, and all of a sudden you then have this connection with the pilgrims in the States, and you've got the Salem witch trials. And suddenly that opens the door to folk horror in specifically white sort of cultural American film history. And that's where it starts getting, and I started getting twitchy at that point. I'm getting really twitchy at that, because to me, it's starting to get that sort of thing. This feels like, hold on, really? Where are we going with this? And I think, you know, when we move on to the next section, they start bringing some films in. I think I could still argue, no, I don't think so. I don't think so. But, you know, what did you think of that?
I like the old ways. You know, I do like that. It's a huge part of it. But at the same time, it's a stretch. For me, something like the witch,
yes.
I'm happy for you to put that in folk horror, because it's going to open up a whole nother world. It's going to a whole nother world of films that you could plonk in here. And again, if I was sorting out my DVD collection, I'm going to put it in with witches. I'm going to put it in with the occult.
So the Wicker Man, I mean, does that not, I mean, we're going to end up sort of having these discussions again, these sort of, well, hold on, what does a cult mean? But then, you know, a cult sort of, I mean, we're going to start sort of discussing, you know, as I said, these lines become really soft and blurry, and it starts becoming more a personal thing of where you're comfortable, where it's going. You start sort of like thinking, yeah, I don't know if witches really do fit within a folk horror type thing. But then you could describe a lot of the characters in The Wicker Man. I mean, the sort of dancing, you know, jumping over flames and stuff like that. That's not much different from the final scene of The Witch.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, ultimately, they're going through a sort of ritual, and it's, you know, you've got this sort of, yes, it's a more modern film, so it's taking, I think, some really sort of beautiful, more modern sort of outtakes on, as he was mentioning in the doc, of what witchcraft meant in terms of female power and things like that. But in the same way, okay, well, you know, your line getting drawn there's a little bit, well, you know, you can see how the occult would be a part of this sort of pagan thing, because the occult seems to derive itself from this idea of a mysterious ancient religion of you know, the souls beyond, you know, beyond the grave and beyond, sort of into nature and beyond our human world, beyond our sort of modern world. So I don't know, it starts getting really fiddly, it starts getting really hard.
I agree, it is really difficult. And as I say, I'm with the Quantum Mass one. If I'm going to draw a line, it is all that technological stuff. But then again, with the stone tapes, that to me is more folk horror-y, and yet it is full of technology. So mm-hmm. I'm just talking
Children
nonsense.
Of the Stones is exactly the same thing. There's the same kind of scientific element in it as well. There's a lot of this stuff. It's really interesting. It's, you know, that the conflict between the modern world and the ancient world, and they do bring it up a few times with a few other movies as well. It's going to get interesting, because I think come the end of the conversation, we're going to say about there's just something I know that I think can kind of wrap it up quite nicely, and it was mentioned in the doc. But yeah, I think moving on to the next bit.
Okay, well, I don't want to be this sort of gatekeeper guy. It's not who I am. It's just that I know where I would put certain films, and I do love things to be in neat little boxes, and art isn't like that.
Yeah, so yeah, that's right.
It's just the way it goes.
That's a good way of putting it, yeah.
Right, so here we go. American folk horror. Here we go in capital.
Here we go, notes. Yep.
So, right, okay, so we're going to just, okay, this is where this is going, and it's got no other choice but to go there, because we've already done, like, all the UK stuff, we've dug deep into the 70s, and maybe just etched out a bit to where it's gone looking forward, and now we are smack bang in the United States of movies, of Hollywood, of boom, like, here we go. So, thoughts on this? No swearing.
No, I mean, yeah, at this point, yeah, I was probably getting close to swearing watching. I knew this is where it was going to go, because obviously I knew this was going to be a global, you know, a documentary about global folk horror. I knew that was where it was going to go. So I sensed that I was quite interested that that's the first place it was going to. I thought that was quite interesting, that it wouldn't go to Eastern Europe and it wouldn't go around the world first. And, you know, I felt maybe that the American stuff might take a smaller part, but maybe that was my own innocence of the idea that it's clearly it's an American film and it's meant for an American audience, which she did mention at the beginning when she was talking about it. She'd be interested to see how British people would take to it, because it's the home of her. And she'd made this in a sense because it was really for an American audience, and they're only just discovering this stuff. So it's like, wow. Yeah, so straight away it goes into that kind of sense. Once it gets beyond the Salem witch trials bit, and once it gets beyond this sort of the pilgrims and the witches, it moves into the very logical next stage, which again we'd already discussed, I think, on the Blood on Satan's Claw, where we spoke about The only way that a lot of the sort of the white American filmmakers could really go, particularly at that time, was to start looking at, because they didn't have this sort of history, they either take it from the old country where they came from, hence the witchcraft and the rest of it coming across the sea, or they take it from these crazy people that were already living here. These savages, these sort of, you know, who had these weird ways about them, and, you know, this strange, and these, you know, and they're this different, terrible moral code. And, you know, if you get caught by these people, oh my goodness, don't, you know. So you have this sort of First Nations sort of kind of thing. And it's like, I just find it really uncomfortable because it feels like it's the only thing they could possibly find that make, because they just don't have, they honestly couldn't find anything else to find. They didn't have their own history. They don't have their own paganism because they came over as Christians and that's it. Well, their only pagan sort of relationship was with these people that were already living here. And so you got a very nicely put together analysis of this idea of the spread and obviously the takeover of that land and what it means, what it meant to the people that already lived there, and how they were made the bad guys, as they so often were in westerns and so on through. And they, even in these movies, in these American folk horror, they were made the bad guys. They were made the scary people with these sort of myths or monsters and stuff that would come after, and it would always be the white person would be the kind of person going into their world. And, you know, and sometimes you would get slightly more sympathetic viewpoints, but it would always be a white person at the center of it. You know, it'd always be the little big man type thing of all the sort of Dances with Wolves. It would always be the white person getting taken in and recognizing that they're not as bad as they would be seen. A really interesting sort of cultural thing. But I think we had the Native American guy on there who was talking about it. He was only in a few bits, but I think the few things that he said were amongst the best bits in the whole documentary. Yeah. And then how did you feel about those bits?
That final quote that, I don't know, actually, I don't think it was him that said it, but someone just said, like, if you're worried about this, like, Indian burial ground.
It was him, yes.
And then you've got the whole of America is your Native American burial ground.
He basically said, what I would really love to scare the white people is, if you're scared of Native American burial grounds, everywhere is a Native American burial ground, as he said. Which is brilliant. It's like, all your houses are built on it. All of them. Not just the poltergeist house. All of them, you know? Not just the Overlook Hotel.
I want Indigenous people to be more thoroughly accepted within this whole filmmaking realm. Imagine the stories. Imagine the years they can go back, and the stories that can be told that we've never heard.
Absolutely. Didn't they do a great bit? I think I'm jumping ahead a little bit because I think it was more the Australian bit that we're going to come to next. But there was a really nice bit that was mentioned where they said, because there was a couple of films that were more made by the Indigenous people, and that at least they had their more of an input into. And it was the idea that their perspective was just the same as ours, but flipped, in the sense that the stuff that was outside to them was scary. And so it just turned out that if they kind of make folk horror films, what you'll find is essentially the same themes, the same ideas, the same feel is there. But all that really gets done is it just flips around the culture. And so to them, their folk horror scary stuff just comes from the people that were coming in and invading. And as he said, that this idea of, I think he mentioned as well, the chap, he said that the fear of colonial states, either states that did the colonizing or the states that were colonized, their greatest fear is being colonized themselves. You know, it's this idea of kind of, you know, why are the states that are so afraid of immigration, the ones that were formed essentially by immigration, you know, is this idea that they realize they know what was so terrible about colonization, because they did it and they know it. So that's why they fear it the most. And it's so true. And when you watch these films, that's really so, it's so obvious when you watch them. And it kind of winds me up when I watch them, because it does feel really, really, what are you doing? You know, it's so, it just feels wrong. It feels really badly sort of like portrayed. But there's also in the American one as well that I thought was quite interesting was the deep sort of Christianity bit, where we start going to the sort of Appalachians and stuff like that. They started talking about the difference between sort of the poorer parts of the cultures and this idea that where you got the people that lived in much poorer areas were considered scarier because they weren't educated and because they, you know, they would have these, you know, going to the deliverance type things and stuff like that. And they had the folk stories because they had the stories that they'd brought over. They had the culture that modern America had kind of lost because they'd built their own stories. And so in a way they had this little bit of this fear of kind of either cults being formed and hence the Jonestown type massacre things, which are genuinely terrifying.
Yeah.
And then you have this sort of idea of the backwaters. And I, at this point, I'm really enjoying this, but I'm now at the point where I'm saying, well, hold on a minute. This is now turning into 50% of American horror movies. Because all of a sudden, well, hold on, we've got Texas Chainsaw Massacre in there. Are you really saying this is related to folk horror because it was set in the countryside? I mean, that's not, I mean, what were we really sort of get? I was really starting to get to that point where it was like, the fog?
I got a ping in my phone when the fog came on the telly. You were like, what's going on? I'm going to throw a couple of things to you, right? Because I can see an argument for these being within the folk horror boundary. So we've got Hills Have Eyes, wasn't mentioned. Pumpkinhead, Deliverance, well, those three, hillbilly horror sort of stuff. Now I can see elements, more elements than in The Fog, for example, within that. And if you transplant that over to, you know, going to bumfucking Devon or whatever, you know, and that, you know, everything's the same except you're in Devon. Well, I can see that totally working.
Would you still have said it was folk horror, even if something like that being lost? I mean, that's starting to go to the point of maybe Straw Dogs. You know, I mean, you're starting to say Straw Dogs is a folk horror film just because it's set in a village or a little town that away from it, and it has, again, the kind of person coming from the city. That seems like that's really starting to cover a lot of sort of ground. And I'm starting to think, well, hold on a minute. Most horror films, you have a person coming into an area where they're uncomfortable. You're not normally going to get a horror film where a person's in a really comfortable environment. Normally you bring them out of that comfortable and put them into an uncomfortable environment. You can't just start saying that is a key part of folk horror, because that's just a key part of horror.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, in a way, you start watering it down to the point, well, now we're just starting to say if it's a horror film but has some element of the countryside outside of the city, basically, or something that's more than about 50 years old, it would seem. You know, I mean, I don't know, The Fog has a story of a ship being sort of washed up 100 years before, because it's a centenary of the town.
Yeah,
so you're talking, what, 100 years? You know, we're talking about that as being like, this is the thing, I guess, that we'd mentioned it before, that to the US 50 years ago, certainly at that time, 50 years ago seemed a long time ago. 100 years ago seemed a really long time ago. It was like, you know, ancient history, because again, the context is kind of gone. They've built their own history. The history starts, you know, in the 18th century kind of thing, virtually.
I love this sort of thing, though, because it is generating this discussion about these films. And whether you label a film this, whether you label a film that, it's getting talked about now. They're bringing this out into the light. And that's exciting, because it's unearthing a great little folk horror thing in my head there. It's unearthing all these lovely, lovely films. But
you are pure quality, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. I've got another one for you, Mark. And when I saw this, it was only a clip. Didn't mention it. It was just a clip. Let's Scare Jessica to Death came on the screen.
Yay! It did.
Like, for me, with the, if you're just taking this one aspect of folk horror, which is it's set in a rural place, and there's sort of ghostly things walking out the grass.
It's a vampire, isn't it? Yeah, it's a vampire. Here we go. Yeah.
I can sort of see this one as well. And yet I'm thinking to myself, that's not a folk horror.
We discussed, when we did the pod on Jessica, we did discuss this again at the end because we were kind of laughing at the end saying this is all we're ever going to talk about is folk horror all the time because it just keeps coming back to it. And in a way, this is what we're saying. It almost starts to feel that every horror film, you're starting to sort of like go, well, that's a bit folk horror, isn't it? You know, Nightmare on Elm Street, there's probably a bit of folk horror in there, isn't there? You know, Freddy's a bit kind of, you know, old stories and fairy tale type things. So yeah, Jessica, again, we mentioned it, and I think at the time one of the things we were saying is it was a really strong cultural film for America. It was about the end of the hippie sort of period and the early 70s and them losing their way and this sort of period of time in America where the 70s was all crazy. And they mentioned this in the documentary, that the reason that the Unholy Trinity came about was because in Britain, roughly the same sort of time in the 60s and through into the 70s, culturally, this was a messy period. It was a dark period. It was a period of time where there wasn't much hope for the future. And the States kind of had a similar kind of feel, where the 60s was very sort of hopeful in lots of ways. A lot of things happened and they lost a lot of this hope and it became very dark. So again, you get this sort of connection of why they were making the films like that. And Jessica's a really, really good example of that. But again, if we're just talking about the idea of city folk moving into the country and some weird shit happening, that's covering an awful lot of horror movie ground, particularly when there's another one that we're talking about as well, because Jessica is about vampires. And this is, again, a really interesting one because it started me thinking. The witchcraft thing, I was like, okay, yeah, we're getting in. I'm starting to think, well, okay, we're just going to start talking about vampire films because that's a, you know, okay, vampire films, folk horror? Like, we can't classify vampire films as hope for witchcraft. Yeah, okay, vampires. But then as we move through this documentary, we start realizing that the vampire myth crosses cultures all over the world. And we're starting to sort of, it really started that, I think, in a way, started getting me thinking about what my definition of it was, why I'm even defining it at all. And it starts to get really interesting because the next section is the one that started to really blow my mind. And when I stopped making notes about things and I just like got lost in the whole river because we moved into
global folk horror.
Folk horror around the world. And it was the bit I was waiting for because it's certainly the most exciting bit in a way.
Before we get into one of my favorite ever films, it did go into Australian folk horror, and that's where it kicked off this whole thing. And I got, again, really? My second little bit of tingles. Whee, I love Australian stuff.
Of course you do. Well, I mean, and I have to say, I was ready to jump on Australia the same as I was jumping up and down on the US, and I was sort of flinging things around the room and said, no, I wasn't really. I was going to. I was actually getting more and more convinced as it was going along, but it's fine. But yeah, the Australian horror, and I was ready to start going and thinking, there you go, it's exactly the same thing. Young, relatively young country, white culture type thing, colonialism, white walking across, the Aboriginal, all their horror films all have this sort of idea of the Aboriginal myths. You know, we have this sort of idea of, you hear the didgeridoos, oh dear, this is it, you don't want to take their land, don't go over there, they'll curse you, they'll do. And it was the Australian section that really started to change my mind. And I think because a couple of the people they got in to talk about the Australian films, and again, my apologies, but everything was going for, I didn't take a note of any names or anything like that. But the two people they got talking about the Australian films, I thought really did a great job of talking about the cultural elements, where it was coming from and where it was going to and why. And I thought they did a really nice job. I think they were much more aware of these problems than a lot of the American commentators, who seem to sort of, in that sense, that they had maybe sort of, they have a different kind of love for these films. It was like they appreciated there were films, but they noticed that there were films made that acknowledged these issues, even at the time, even back in the 80s, which I thought was really nice. And they were pointing these films out and saying, actually, they didn't even realize it. Mm. But at the time, they were talking about this stuff.
So that's the films The Dreaming and Kadacha. I thoroughly love that part as well, because they've got, it's all happening around 1988 with the bicentenary of the white settlers. And
the country's anniversary, saying the birthday of the country, and even that they sort of seemed almost slightly embarrassed with it, didn't they?
I remember that being a real turning point. Not that I was living there at the time, but even at that age of the indigenous peoples now being accepted, and people, white people, apologizing publicly, officials, like, you know, and this wasn't, this isn't happening in America, nowhere near to the same level as in Australia. And so maybe that's why there's such a shift between the two as it stands at the moment.
Do you think, I had a thought, and maybe you'd have more of an answer of this for me, but I felt that it felt more because they started talking more about what they'd been discussing with the British section, with the psychogeography. And they started talking because you look at things like Picnic at Hanging Rock and stuff like that, which is one of my favorite films. I absolutely love that film. And they spoke about it in the sense that indigenism wasn't mentioned, but what they're talking about was the land having this memory and yeah. The land having something in it. Again, we come back to this thing with the structure, the rocks, the standing stones, whatever you want to call them. And you don't even have to mention the people that lived there. You don't have to, because they were acknowledging that the land itself has these memories, the memories of their colonialism. It's almost etched into the land, and these films acknowledge that. And I thought maybe it's the idea that Australia is still a much wilder country than a lot of America, or at least than a lot of America believes it is. I mean, America is still a pretty wild country in a lot of places, but Australia really is. I mean, Australia is apart from these tiny little bits around the outside, yeah. Australia is still a really, you know, barren, not barren. I mean, it is a very barren, wrong word, but it's still wilderness, proper dangerous wilderness in the 95% of that country, maybe more. And I felt maybe that was a difference, that people kind of knew that a bit more. There's a bit more fear of the land, a bit more fear of this land can kill you. Whereas the Americans still had this sort of sense of, even though the American landscape killed plenty of people, they still feel they could own the land. They still feel the land was theirs, rather than them belonging to the land themselves. And I felt the Australian one maybe is a bit different.
Yeah, I had a lot of love for that section. I felt like that's where everything had sort of caught up with regards to the filmmaking, where they knew that this was going to be an expansive documentary. And they got the right heads to talk to, and the right films were picked. And as you say, even though when they didn't mention these films don't mention these indigenous peoples.
Yeah.
It is everywhere. It is every shot, every reaction shot on the white man's face. It tells a thousand stories.
Yeah.
And again, coming out of the land, is it folk horror? Yeah, I didn't think of it before. I'd see Wolf Creek. That, to me, is not a folk horror film.
That one, I have to say, was maybe a bit of a stretch. I remember that one. That was a bit, well, really? That's more just like your kind of, again, a backwater type one, isn't it? It's a pretty scary film. But, you know, we're edging back into the wrong turn sort of territory of movies. Again, this sort of idea of, you know, the crazy person that lives in the hut in the woods kind of thing. Is that really folk horror? Probably not. I think there were probably better choices than that one, but
as much as I agree with that, I'm loath to actually stick my flag in that hill and die on it now, because who's making these horror rules?
Well, exactly. But this is my point. You don't have to. You know, it's not a hill you need to die on, because we're coming to the point again where we're saying, like, everyone's definition of it is different. And this film, this documentary, if anything, is just hammering that point home constantly. Absolutely constantly. And as we move through this section, I am just on a magic carpet ride now, because it's now just going to take me out of my comfort zone completely and into a different world, where, again, I am now about to realize that I am just this colonial moron that sits and thinks that my culture and my history is the only one that matters, and it is the only one that really exists and should be preserved with all its beauty, and no one else can come in and look at it and touch it and do anything. And you just then turn around and realize that, how special really is it? I mean, yes, it's special, but how special? Everyone's culture has it, you know. That's, and it, we're about, this is it, you know, we're now walking into this world of, okay.
We're a blip, and we're just as important as everyone else's blips. So, okay. Yeah, yeah. One of my favourite films mentioned in this whole thing, I'm pretty sure you'll agree, Onibaba. I flipping love it. I watched this one after work one day and I instantly thought to myself, wow, other countries do folk horror. So before this documentary, I was already, oh, wow, other countries do this. And also, what a film. Like, it was the first time that I watched a film during the day and then put it on again at night because I would just, I couldn't believe what I'd seen. I loved it.
Yeah.
You must love this.
Yeah. This is, I mean, it's an absolute classic, isn't it? And I mean, it really is. It's one of those really great, I mean, let's start by saying Japanese folk horror. We may as well say basic Japanese horror, because this, I mean, you know, straight away, here you go. Here's a culture where you sit and say, well, folk horror, yeah, it's a British thing because we can go back so many years and we've got all this pagan stuff. And then you like go, well, Japan still basically has it. I mean, it's Shinto, it's Buddhism, but it's like, essentially, they, you know, it was really, really lovely seeing this idea that, well, yeah, because this is Japanese horror comes from this. The horror stories that have been written in Japanese literature comes from all of this. They didn't even think about it. They don't sit there and think, oh, but that's kind of similar to, you know, the Unholy Trilogy of those British folk horror films. They're just like, yeah, we've been doing that since, you know, the 20s kind of thing. We've been making it, or we've been writing stories like this since the 16th century or what have you, you know. It's just what they do. This is their effort. And you know, quite Onibaba is a particularly nice example of it in a way, because one of the nice things about Onibaba is it thrusts a certain modern style of filmmaking into that sort of Japanese folk ghost type story. The idea of the mask and the possession and things like that, and the curse and stuff like that. But it also has a very modern, and it feels really strange. I don't know about you, but one of the strange things that I had about watching that film was it felt really bizarrely modern in some ways. It's a 60s film, and it had a kind of set that the sexual politics in it. We're like, oh, hold on, okay.
Yeah.
This didn't, you know, I was expecting it to be quite a staid, almost sort of Kurosawa-esque, sort of samurai type, you know, sort of very sort of quite sort of rigid and very Ozu Japanese in style. And it actually is quite like, whoa, okay, this is the 60s. Okay, you know, there's a lot of sexually liberation sort of stuff going on. These women are essentially doing all sorts of stuff to trap samurai, and this guy walks in and the contrast with it is really nice. That's one of the great things about that film. And then one of the other films they mention in the Japanese section, of course, is Kwaidan.
Yet to see it.
Just watched it the other night. Sort of as a rewatch. It's again one of the great epic sort of horror films of Japanese cinema, and that does maybe a slightly different thing. And that really takes these really ancient stories and tells them as if they are. It almost does a sort of thing where it's a bit like Witchfinder General in a way. It's sort of puts you back in the time of these sort of stories and takes you there, but it does it in an incredibly exotic way. The artistry of the cinematography and so on is quite incredible in it. It's almost unreal. It's almost like a theatrical set piece, the light and the color and so on. It had that almost a bit like, it's a weird reference to use with Quieter, but Creepshow, you know, where Creepshow is done in such a way, it's a bit like the comics, and the lighting is always crazy, and it goes, you know, because comic books have this sort of solid color, right? With Quieter, and you get the idea that it's to do with like almost like painting. So you get all these solid colors getting used, and the backdrops are clearly painted. They're clearly like theatrical, almost backdrops a lot of the time, you know, and these are almost like stages with performances going on. And, but again, these are sort of fairy tales. These are folk stories. These are the telling. At that point, you're like sort of sitting, here we go, this is it. You know, the world is full of this. This is it. You know, I'm now sort of, This is the deep dive into the world of sort of folk stories, and it becomes a much richer story to tell, I think, at this point. I started getting kind of a bit more emotionally involved in it at this point, because it starts making you feel, wow, this is actually incredible. This is a connection thing between people around the world.
I thought that it was a pretty cool place to put this segment, because you're hitting the final hour and people, if you're just coming at this, not as excited as we are, but just coming at this, you know, I'm going to watch a documentary about horror. I can see people waning here because this is like international stuff, subtitles everywhere.
World cinema, yeah, here we go, yeah.
You know, and you've stuck it onto that last hour. You've already had 2 hours of the good stuff, you know, this is the stuff I recognise. And then all of a sudden we're drifting to some real arty stuff, some real heavy themes, international backgrounds that, you know, are not recognizable.
As soon as you mentioned the word art house, isn't it? So this is where you kind of feel that it's sort of like, because Japanese film does sometimes get stuck into that, because a lot of the Japanese films that get released worldwide, particularly before the sort of J-horror periods, it was always art house. It was always described as art house. You know, they won awards at Cannes and stuff like that. You know, there was this sort of like the Akira Kurosawas, that, you know, the Yasujiro Ozus, these people, the Mitsubishis, they were art house. They made these amazingly rich, simple, you know, cultural films that, you know, were about, you know, very deep sort of family sort of issue dramas. You never felt that it was like popular sort of culture getting thrown. But, you know, J-horror did try and change that. And the new K sort of K-movie sort of thing that's going on as well, where a lot of the Korean films that are coming out now, it's a lot more entertainment based, and, you know, we've changed our minds a bit. So I guess that's where maybe the Japanese stuff gets put into that category now, because Japanese film now, we're a bit more aware that there is a bit more, you know, it's more of a sort of...
Say this, right?
Yeah.
What the hell, and I've written this down, ask Mark, what the hell is the ghost cat genre? What is this?
I didn't know about this myself. No, I didn't know this, but this is really funny. I guess it's just one of those, I suppose, the idea of sort of animal analogues, the idea of sort of spirits being sort of taken into animals and stuff like that. But I had no clue. I hadn't seen any of those films. Brilliant. This was one of the bits that was just like, what? Because it was a bit kind of bizarre where they said there was like this series of six films that were just made at this period or something that was just about cats and sort of vengeful spirits getting into cats.
I've put them on my list. I've found a bunch.
Yeah, so
I've put them on my list. Okay.
No, I didn't know. I have to admit. Jasper Sharp, who was on that bit, one of the talking heads, I know, because he's a big sort of, he's a big voice in sort of the Western appreciation of Japanese cinema in the 90s and early 2000s. So he knows his stuff. So the stuff that was coming from Japan was good stuff, yeah.
To shorten this section out a bit, they do talk about Mexican stuff, Italian stuff. They mentioned Don't Torture a Duckling, which I thought, putting that in there. Yeah. What are you up to?
There's a witch in it. Come on, there you go.
Okay, I was expecting Suspiria to pop up at any moment.
This is it, isn't it? You know, well, you got your witches in one, you got your witches in another. What makes the difference between one witch and another? I don't know. I guess Don't Torture a Duckling's more in the countryside.
Mm-hmm,
there you go. Yeah, no, Suspiria's in what? Is it in Milan or is it in, I can't remember what city it's in, but, you know, it's in the city. Witches in the city don't count. Witches in the countryside, yeah, that does count. Right?
Okay. All right. Well, okay. There's a couple of omissions that I wrote down, and as soon as it went to this section, I couldn't wait for them to talk about it. So I made a note of it and waited for it to come, and it didn't come. So I've got the Seventh Seal and I've got the Virgin Spring, both missing. If you're going to include a lot of stuff that they've already included, mention these at least as an afterthought.
Virgin Spring, I haven't seen, so I can't comment on that one. Seventh Seal, that's a really interesting one. Yeah, I guess the point might be, although they do mention what Bergman's Hour of the Wolf, that is mentioned, but I think that's the only Bergman they mention. And I guess Seventh Seal, that's a really interesting point. I guess maybe some people might not consider it a horror, which I guess would maybe.
You're right.
I can only imagine, because although, yes, it's clearly a medieval set story and it involves, you know, the spirit of death, I suppose, I have to admit there are certainly some scenes in it, now I'm thinking about it, that I would consider to be fairly, I wouldn't describe them as horrific, because it's not a horrific film, but there are certainly some scenes in it. At the end, the dance of all the characters dancing on the way with death at the front going to hell. Mm-hmm. That to me is a shot from a horror film. You know, that is that sort of silhouette kind of thing with that's a horror film shot. So, you know, and the figure itself of death, I would say, is a horror figure. you know, he looks like a figure from a horror film. So, you know, yeah, I can see why you would think so. And I can also maybe see why it wouldn't be as well. So
I guess again, it's the same thing with like a Field in England, where some people say, oh, it's not a horror, it's just a folk tale. You know, so I can see that. I can see it. I was just so shocked. I wanted some more info on it. You know, I wanted it to be added to this plethora of films that they're chucking out at us, and it just was missed off. And I was like,
well, yeah, therefore your definition, maybe, I mean, this is the idea, would a folk tale, is that not, is it more important that it's a horror film than it's a folk film? I mean, that's a weird one, isn't it, in a way, because, you know, you're then just sort of classifying most horror films as having folky elements in them, could all be folk horror, but then a folky film that has a bit of a horror element in it, why wouldn't that be considered a folk horror film? It's a bit of a strange sort of contrast, but I mean, yeah, I think this is the point where we start sort of sitting there, and I'm, you know, we're going through, it goes through the Eastern European bits. We start again getting vampires in there, which again, I was sort of like, at this point, I'm like, okay, we're back to vampires again. And we start realizing that, yeah, vampires are such an innate part, particularly in Eastern Europe, of their cultural history. It's, you know, I had this sort of like thing of, what am I sitting here? I'm sitting thinking Bram Stoker is my sort of cultural touch point for this. And it's like ridiculous. Vampires are essentially a worldwide thing. This drinking blood, this is, you know, this is, you know, Joe was sort of asking me as well, did they sort of bring up a lot of the sort of things like Chupacabra, the goat drinking. And I was like, no, that's a monster film. And then I'm like, well, hold on, that's a folk tale. Yeah. These creatures, this sort of cryptozoology and stuff like that, these are almost like folk tales as well, aren't they? This sort of idea of the creatures that live out in the woods, that, you know, they mention werewolves, Company of Wolves is there, the folk stories of sort of werewolves and wolves and the mixture of that, you know, and it's just got this weird blend. And I started to realize, and I was at this point, I was so into it, there were two things sort of came to mind. And we started to move into the sort of final section, which was the kind of the modern horror, you know, this sort of the folk horror revival, I think.
Revival.
And by this point, we'd gone through this sort of Eastern European bit and the South American bit. And as you were saying, the Italian bit, which had some really interesting movies. I'd really like to see some of those ones. And it was just witches, monsters, and it was, you know, it was throwing things at you, and then weird ones that you'd never heard of before. And it was flinging things at you. Each film was different. And there was the stories, and it was like, absolutely, it was starting to get, you know, this sort of hypnotic almost. Another film and another scene of weird vampire hairy woman on the back of a man, you know, and sort of riding him like a horse, and you're like, why is this? And I realized at this point that I kind of lost track in a way of what I was actually either annoyed about at the beginning. I wasn't really ever annoyed, but what I was questioning at the beginning. Yeah. And I'd got to the point where I was sitting there and I was just thinking to myself, horror films are great. Horror films are amazing. I mean, this is, it was reminding me of why I love horror films, and I love all films, but why I sort of have a particular thing that horror films of any other genre stand sort of proud of the rest of a lot of the cinematic genres. And you just realize that it's so blooming universal in every way. You know, you can look at sort of love being universal, but everyone, different cultures have different ways of expressing love in lots of different ways a lot of the time, you know. And you feel that the family units, family and stuff like that, is very different in different cultures. It has to be. Horror, you have this feel that this idea of folk horror, the way they were expressing it in this documentary, was such a connective thing. And you were just seeing so many things, but realizing this is just horror movies. These people are just making horror movies, but they're using it as an expression of their culture that may have been lost, or maybe being lost in some way. There was a lot of the sense of people that had been colonized, and this idea of the cultures that were missing, that were dying off, and this idea that we were now entering another time where these cultures needed to sort of find their history, and they needed to be more proud of this sort of idea that the the way technology is sort of gradually eroding it, and how we feel that we're, you know, what was the great quote? The guy said that there was an article written after something which said the end of history or something, or a book had been written and it was the end of history. It was the idea of that's it, you know, the liberal West technological culture has now taken over and we don't have to worry about anything anymore because eventually we'll sweep the world because it's just the best way of doing things and everyone will agree with us and we'll have some sort of utopia at some point. And it was like, no, that didn't happen, did it?
And it's give it a few weeks
because we all feel horror in the same way, and we communicate it using these sort of primal stories. The stories that connect us with our culture, and that's what I felt when I was sitting there thinking. That's why I felt so connected to mine at the beginning, and I was so protective of it because I was connected to my sort of cultural thread. I wanted it to mean something. I wanted it to be sort of real. And by the end of it, I'd realize it does. But that's because it means something to me and to the people that made the films. In the same way that the films around the world mean something to the people that are making those films and watching those films. And what a great connection it was in horror movies. Just, yeah.
Do you know what? I think that is a perfect way to wrap up, but I'm not going to let you wrap up there, because that would be just too easy. So during this revival section that they did, sort of not tagged on the end, but I feel like you couldn't wrap up the film any other way. I wrote down 10 and as it was going along, again, just throwing titles out at you and clips. And it became, at this point, it became a little bit like one of those clip shows that you get on Shudder, like the 80s horror doc or whatever it is. So it was like, it hadn't exactly given up on what went before, but it was like, okay, we're just going to wrap up. This is sort of a final thing. So we've got Wakewood, November, The Borderlands, Midsummer, Kill List, Pyewacket, The Ritual, The Witch, The Village, and Border. Now, this is all stuff from the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And it's a really nice cross-section of what they would consider in this film, in the making of this film, the directors, and everybody that's put this together.
Yeah.
And I think that's a nice broad stretch. There's some that I'd be like, and there's some that I'd be like, yep.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
The question here is, where do you think it's going to go from here? Where do you think it's going to go in the future when this is the last 10 years worth?
Wow, that's a really good question. Yeah, I mean, reflecting on that bit, it was quite interesting, as you say, because what they seemed to do was to kind of bring it home in that sort of sense, where we'd sort of had this great universal horror sort of idea, not universal horror, Frankenstein, this idea of horror being universal, of crossing those divides of every culture, every person having that sort of feel of folk horror in them in some way. And they sort of brought it back to, right, okay, we'll bring it back. And what they did was they brought this folk horror revival, they seem to suggest. It does seem to be a very Western thing. It does seem to be a very kind of, it's maybe even more of a Hollywood thing than it is a British thing. I don't know. I think there's still a British sort of filmmaking element in it. And I guess there have been a few films that you know, sort of, again, like you were sort of like saying, like Field in England and Kill List, that are more sort of British films, but a lot of the American filmmakers are taking this on now, mm-hmm. and are sort of looking to other cultures around the world. And it was interesting that they put Midsommar in there, and as they said, Midsommar is not a Scandinavian film, it's an American film. It's a very American film. It feels like a very American film, which is quite funny. It's got a British actress in it, and it's clearly set in the middle of Sweden, so quite a bizarre sort of idea. I guess Ari Aster's films, I think we're starting to sense, have got this sort of weird sense of location about them, which is a bit peculiar. They're kind of outside. He doesn't really place things in very strict boundaries a lot of the time. I think his artistic vision is very broad in that sort of sense. I think he just likes putting things 100%. In place,
yeah, and definitely.
Sort of mixing things up. So the idea of where it's going to go, well, it senses to me, if it was me, going to be a bit cynical about it. To me, it senses like it's just heading towards Hollywood. And to me, it feels like a J horror, where you're going to get a lot of work from a lot of the original countries. You're going to get money put into it, and they're going to make a lot more films. So we'll probably get lots of little folk horror type films made around the world, because people will be hoping that they'll be able to sell these films around the world. I just watched one the other night. I've actually forgotten what it was called, but it's a short film from Brazil, and it's involving a kind of mermaid type fish person that's caught in a net, but it's a little village, and the guys that come to the village that do the fishing, they basically assault the women in their place, and so they use this sort of mermaid as revenge. It's a really strange sort of film, but it has that kind of idea of a relatively modern kind of folky horror type thing, but you feel it's been made for showing at festivals and stuff, a lot like J Horror did, where a lot of money got pumped into these movies in Japan and in Korea, and it almost created a new film industry in the original countries. But ultimately, it was for ingestion in the West. It's because the money in the West that people were lapping it up. And I feel folk horror has got that feel to it. And you feel Hollywood's taking it on, and they're going to start, they'll remake stuff, and you'll get people that work in horror in America. They'll start putting all these folk elements in, and they'll start. And Ari Aster's a really good example, because, he's got a kind of auteurish kind of feel to him, but at the same time, I couldn't help feel that Midsommar, I know you feel it's an almost perfect film.
Yeah.
But to me, I did sometimes feel a little uncomfortable, because it felt weirdly appropriistic.
Right.
In a kind of, well, I don't know. I know the Swedes kind of were really chilled out about it, as they pretty much would be. I think most of them just thought, this is great, you know, yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Well, what the hell? Yeah, if that's what they want to think. Great. I felt it was kind of had a really weird Hollywoody feel to it. And apart from the how well made it is, and his films are so beautifully made, I did feel there was an element that he'd kind of gone, what can I do? I could take some bits of this kind of folk horror type stuff. What would be an interesting culture that hasn't been ripped apart from? Well, I can't really do that sort of thing in a culture now that's maybe of sort of indigenous cultures. I can't do that. I can't do it from cultures of different color, because if I did that, I'm just essentially going to be, I know what I can, what would be the best culture that's not been sort of explored? Oh, I guess Scandinavia, they don't care. I could do any kind of stuff that would be deemed, like, I don't know, racist or something, and they're just going to go, yeah, through.
I'm an American.
And it had that, it was a little uncomfortable with some of it. And it, you know, there was a mixture with how well done it was, and a certain sense of, wow, if he'd have set this in a different country, he could have been in serious shit, you know. Because it did have a little bit of that Native American kind of, oh, you don't want to go down there, these crazy people, these crazy foreign people that you don't understand the language, you know, what's all this crazy stuff going on, you know. It did have that, and I thought that Hollywoodization, I feel, maybe is the way it's going to go. But I do have faith that there will be money pumped into a lot of these films, hopefully, around the world, and there will be more good ones made as well from, you know, of decent filmmakers that, you know, that I think there's going to be a lot of rubbish made as well, is what I'm saying. And I think we might reach saturation points at that as well.
So in 20 years, we're going to look at Midsommar like we look at Alf Garnett now.
No, I don't know. Maybe the Swedes will turn around and go, right, you racist.
How the f-
Oh, I see, bloody American colonial.
Wow.
Of course, the Americans could turn around and say that the Scandinavians were the original colonists of America. So there you go. You know? So they haven't got really much of an argument.
I didn't think we would end here.
I don't know. It was just like that. I mean, but yeah, the next 10 years, that's how I kind of feel, like a lot of these things. It's already feels a bit like it's starting to get watered down. And, you know, this documentary feels a bit like a full stop in a way. I think it's almost so comprehensive that you feel anything that comes after this now is just going to be a sense of, oh, they probably watched Woodlands Dark and Days Bewitched and kind of went, ooh. Well, this is, you know, this has got,
it's a really good point.
It's getting a lot of chat. I mean, it is, although it's not been released, it's not going to be on Blu-ray, I think, till December. And it's just getting shown around the world at film festivals. It is getting a lot of traction. A lot of people are talking about it. And I think it's going to have an influence. And I think the influence won't necessarily be good. I think it will be good in some places and not good overall.
Well, I think so, this is how I would see that. And I mean, I see your point really well. And the cynic in me, yeah, I can see that. I mean, I've already been priced out of buying this beautiful box set with so many. You know, I said to you, I'm already going to have all the films in it. I'm not going to get it. And then I had two films out of like 40 or whatever there was in there. Yeah. And the booklet and the artwork, I was like, oh my, it's blowing my mind. But I'm priced out. But like, good luck to them for putting together such a beautiful package. Yeah. And for those that can afford it, just jump on it because that looks beautiful.
Yes, it's the less cynical way of looking at it. And although I mentioned it, I guess there's not the cynical saturation side of it. Yes, if it gives somebody who wouldn't normally have got the opportunity but wants to tell a story like this an opportunity to do it, then yes, that can only be a good thing. And as I said, horror movies, you know, this is where our love of horror movies should be. And the more horror movies are made, I guess, more power to them. Although I do worry sometimes that the more things that are made, it's harder to find the good stuff, because invariably most stuff isn't as good as the good stuff, so you end up with an awful lot more of the stuff that isn't great. And that's, you know, so again, that's the cynic in me, where, you know, so the yes, it's great if someone can make a great story that wouldn't have done before, yes, brilliant. But let's hope that happens and we don't all just get so sick of it because of the 57th remake of The Wicker Man or whatever, or, you know, if they even think about remaking The Blood on Satan's Claw, that'll be hilarious. But, you know, I don't know. Netflix will probably do it. I mean, Christ, full of teenagers. Netflix are going to love that, aren't they? They're going to love a remake of Blood on Satan's Claw. That's going to be great. That is. Yeah, I think horror movies are always going to be made. I'm a cynical sort of person like that, because horror movies make money and always have done and probably always will do. You know, and I think they're always going to get made, and an awful lot of them are still going to be bad.
I sort of like the bad ones too.
Oh, well. Actually, you know that. You've got to. You've got to do a podcast on all of them. I can just sit and pick and choose them.
Thank you so much for taking part in this discussion. And that's it. What a documentary that was. As I mentioned at the very top, next week, myself and Mark, we will be chatting again. We're going to be releasing side one of the Wicker Man soundtrack chat. And the following week, we're going to put out side two of the Wicker Man chat. But until then, feel free to contact this very podcast at ayearinhorror@gmail.com. I would love to know your thoughts on Woodland Dark and Days Bewitched as well. So if you have any thoughts and maybe you want me to read them out, just let me know. Also, you can follow me at Waller Not Weller on Letterboxd, also Waller Not Weller on Instagram. If you feel like it, you can hit me up at Not Weller Pod on Twitter. And that is your lot. We'll see you soon. See you next week for more folk horror nonsense. Until then, may your days be bewitched.